Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, the fastest capo in the West. Steve Goodman used to say that when you write a country and western song, you had to have certain themes, you know, the pickup truck and mother and the railroad train and all that.
When you jail.
When you write a bluegrass song, do you have to have dirt and crossing over Jordan?
I don't know. I think it helps. There are certainly lots of good words if you decide to write about dirt. Lots of good words you can use that are right in the bluegrass genre. Same thing with trucks and muddy rivers.
It's easier than writing about oranges, for example.
Sure, right. Yeah. I don't know. It just seems to flow naturally to those topics sometimes.
Well, you have all that bluegrass fodder you can choose from.
That's right.
There's a whole vocabulary in bluegrass music that...
Certainly.
...that we don't generally find in other genres.
Yeah, and there are those good words, you know, that you can use, like plunged. He took the dagger and he plunged it through her heart. You know, this is why we write bluegrass.
That's right.
So to be able to use words like plunged.
That's right.
Words like sensuous. sensuous up, would you get me a beer?
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. Oh.
Exactly. Let's go eat. That's the, of course, contraction of let's go eat.
Squeet.
Squeet.
I thought it was jeet.
Jeet?
Oh,
no, thanks.
No, Jew?
Yeah, really. I'm sorry, we're degenerating here.
Sorry, yes.
When you start out to write a bluegrass song, do you go in with you know, some sort of an idea that you're looking for something that a bluegrass band might do?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that first tune we played, One More Dollar, qualifies as a bluegrass song.
No.
But National Bluegrass Band is doing it.
Really?
So they've sort of given it like...
Well, this is like good news.
...the bluegrass seal of approval.
Yeah.
So let's consider that a bluegrass song for a moment.
But on the other hand, the Nashville Bluegrass Band has recorded Richard Thompson's songs.
This is true, too. But
did a lovely job.
They always do their bluegrass treatment of
it. Yeah, in 2 minutes and 47 seconds of
a four-minute
song.
That's right. But that one started with an idea about someone leaving his home to pick fruit. And all I knew was I wanted to rhyme fruit trees with suit me. And that...
So this is like an intellectual exercise.
Well, no.
You pick out something unlikely.
Because that rhyme wasn't intellectual. It just, like, popped into my head when I thought about migrant pickers.
Who's... John Prine's written a bunch of John Prine songs. When you find out what the kernel was, it's one of those really funny rhymes in the middle that you've never heard before.
Right.
Like, what kind of song could include, you know, blow up my TV or, you know,
right.
Whatever.
So.
Do you go out looking for songwriting challenges like that?
I don't know that I go looking for them. They seem
They're
to find me.
They're just kind of presented
me.
To you.
One of the only things I've done consciously is once I made the acquaintance of the guys in Nashville Bluegrass Band, I realized that I had very little material that I could place with them because so many of my narrators were women. I all of a sudden realized which of my songs were gender-specific and which weren't. I had a few that were either non-specific or happened to be from a male perspective. And so... ...a classic. Everybody wants to do that,
yeah.
You know, so...
Do you think about that when you're writing or afterwards? Is it in the writing or the editing process that you try to make it non-time-specific?
Sometimes both. Because, you know, as far as the form of a tune, or, you know, it comes in both sides of the process. Sometimes more in the editing, you know, if something is particularly timely, you know, I might take it out, you know, to try to non-specify things or whatever.
Are you surprised when people pick up your tunes at this point?
Well, I'm still surprised to hear them.
Yeah.
We were at a festival in Knoxville a couple weekends ago, and we were up in the balcony of this theater, and there were some people jamming down on the first level.
We were trying to get some sleep.
We were trying to take a nap, because it'd been a long day. And I heard someone in a picking circle call one of my tunes, and that's the first time that's ever happened to me. You know, it's very strange that on some level they've joined the public, you know, song pool. That is very freaky for me.
So all of a sudden you've written a traditional song that bluegrass.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's
guys are
going to
be swelling long necks in the parking lot and.
Yeah, so I have yet to hear anything on the radio. You know, like just turn the radio on and bump into something.
You've never heard one of Tim and Molly's versions of one of your songs?
Not
on
unless
the radio?
I was sitting in the DJ booth.
Oh.
Not unless I've been doing a spot on a. I've never just turned on the radio. And
well, let's see. You'll be on 93. And
so that milestone remains to, you know.
Are you surprised with what, say, Tim and Molly did with your songs?
No.
No?
No. Wichita, you know, it. As far as I can understand, many artists are perpetually on a quest for up-tempo material.
Right, so because it's so easy to write depressing songs. Right.
Yeah, I don't know, something about the natural inclination of songwriters. But so it doesn't surprise me at all that they do my tune Wichita at a faster clip than we do. Other than that, the arrangement is pretty much as we do it, except that they added a solo, which also makes sense to me because they're virtuoso pickers there. So, no, I don't think I've been surprised yet by an arrangement.
Speaking of virtuoso pickers, how did David end up in the picture here?
We met in Boston. Mm-hmm. We were both attending Berklee College of Music, and we played, we were in the, you know, small, strange bluegrass community there, the Outcasts. You know, I would sit in my jazz labs, everyone with their big jazz guitars, and I was playing my guild, you know, one and only flat top in the room. But Dave and I met there, and then about a year after meeting, moved down to Nashville.
I'm guessing you weren't studying bluegrass guitar at Berklee.
I was studying guitar.
Yeah.
And hard to say, I wasn't really ready or that interested in learning jazz, so it was kind of more of a general thing where it was very nice to be able to play all day in class and then go play in bands at night and just pretty much play all the time.
Yeah.
So that was my favorite thing about the school. It really gave me an opportunity to, I don't know, to kind of grow for a couple of years without having to work a day job.
Or make a living.
That's right.
What were you playing before you got there?
Before I got to Berklee, I mean, through Berklee, I was playing, I played in the country circuit up and around Boston and through Rhode Island from, I was in a punk band at one point and, you know, when I was 18 or so, and they weren't making any money, and I needed to make some money.
Kind of by definition.
Right. And I didn't want to get a job, so I joined a country band, and because they were working every weekend and, you know, making $70 a night each, so I was happy with that, and I just ended up continuing to do that and continuing to play in punk bands that made no money all the way through Berklee. So, I don't know, I was playing a lot of, but I was playing electric guitar primarily. Didn't really start playing acoustic until I got to Nashville and then just fell in love with it.
We didn't start arranging my stuff for two acoustic guitars until we lived in Nashville for a couple months.
Yeah.
And then I was ready to start hitting the open mics and the writers' nights, and Dave, you know, kindly volunteered to come along and help out, and so this whole thing started. That's how this started.
And then we found out we could kind of sing together okay.
Yeah.
And this was a happy coincidence.
Yeah.
Open mics at the Bluebird and all that?
Yeah.
Writers' nights?
At the Bluebird and half a dozen other places that don't exist anymore, because these things turn over so quickly. The people who
everywhere
run them go insane,
right,
after, you know, 9 months of hearing, you know, every writer in town's three songs every night. But yeah, the Bluebird was certainly the best of all of the open mics and writers' nights, and we still play there.
Kind of intimidating when you never know who's going to be in the audience.
It is. It's best not to think about it too much, because it really is true. There are no, like, blow-off gigs. I learned that. Whenever you think, you know, oh, this is a, no one's going to be here, doesn't matter, you find out that, you know, some huge personality is there.
Want to do another one for us?
Sure.